One of the important events that took place in the region at that time was the formation of a process of reconciliation through Arab-Israeli negotiations, which is referred to as the peace process. This trend was shaped after Arab-Israeli negotiations. Recall that in 1993, an agreement was reached between Mr. Yasser Arafat and the Israelis, represented by Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres, an agreement that was finalized under the auspices of the United States. This agreement was eventually named the Oslo Accords. This was naturally a very dangerous issue and had a negative impact on the Arab-Israeli conflict. The danger was that, according to the agreement, the PLO recognized Israel and thus effectively a Palestinian group, not an Egyptian one like Anwar Sadat, abandoned the lands of 1948, the lands occupied by the Zionist regime during the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. Also, in that agreement, it was mentioned that the topic of the negotiations would be East Jerusalem and the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and the issue of other parts of Palestine is already done. This was a major fault. On the other hand, the agreement opened the way for many other Arab countries to begin negotiations and reach an agreement with Israel, eventually normalizing relations with Tel Aviv. This was a very dangerous issue. At that time, the leader and the Palestinian resistance groups, including Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, opposed the Oslo Accords. The commander-in-chief and some Palestinian groups opposed the deal. So did Hezbollah and the Lebanese groups. We rallied against this agreement, but were shot, and we had martyrs for the cause in Beirut's southern Dahiya. In any case, it was a turning point and a very dangerous period. We pondered over what reaction to adopt against the Oslo Accord. Should we deal with it politically and through the media and call on the Palestinians to resist and insist on their rights? The emergence of this issue, the Oslo Accords and the ensuing phase, led to the expansion and consolidation of relations between Hezbollah and Palestinian groups, including Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, and also strengthened the path of resistance in the occupied territories of Palestine. Remember that at that time, a major martyrdom-seeking operation was carried out by Hamas and Islamic Jihad militants in the heart of Tel Aviv and Quds, and shook the Zionist authorities to their core. It was after that operation that an extraordinary meeting took place in the Egyptian city of Sharm el-Sheikh with Clinton and Yeltsin, the then Russian president, in attendance. Many countries in the world also attended this meeting. I remember that the Chinese president and many heads of state of Arab countries, including Syria and Lebanon, were invited to the meeting. Meanwhile, the late Syrian president Hafez Assad rejected participating in the meeting. The fact is that the meeting finally declared war on three groups. First, Hezbollah, second, Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, and third, the Islamic Republic of Iran, due to its support for resistance in the region. Despite its large sphere, the meeting did not manage to introduce fear in the ranks of Hezbollah and other resistance groups in the region, especially since at that time, the position of the leader regarding the resistance, that is, continuing the resistance and persisting on the path, was absolutely straightforward and resolute. Therefore, the Oslo Accord brought about a series of events, events that were very crucial and hazardous for this procedure.
We also had the Madrid Conference.
The Madrid Conference was before the Oslo Accord. It was then that the talks started. The important point here is that the leader has a very deep insight and exact understanding of the future. I believe that his accurate perception of the future is part of his unique abilities, derived from his deep faith in, submission to, and relationship with the Almighty God, rather than having an only rational aspect. At that time, certain talks started, called the Israeli-Syrian negotiations. The Syrian president of the time was Hafez al-Assad, and the Israeli prime minister was Yitzhak Rabin. The talks between them were initially secret and later made public. They would meet in the United States and under Clinton's supervision. Representatives of President Assad and Rabin's cabinet met with each other in the United States, and they were about to come to an agreement. At that time, it was said that Yitzhak Rabin had agreed to return the occupied Golan to Hafez al-Assad. Accordingly, there was an assumption in the region that Israel and Syria were coming to an agreement. This atmosphere existed in Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and the entire region. I remember that at that time, some would ask us, if an Israeli-Syrian agreement is reached, what will you, that is Hezbollah, do? If Syria and Israel come to an agreement, what stance will Hezbollah take? If such an agreement is made, what will be the fate of Hezbollah and the Islamic resistance groups? We organized several meetings to discuss the matter and plan for the future. We thought then that an agreement was already made between Assad and Rabin. It was not only Hezbollah, but all Lebanese, Syrians and Palestinians assumed that the agreement had been finalized. We organized internal meetings to discuss the future. We talked about political, military, artillery issues, and even the name of the group. Some raised the question whether or not to keep the name Hezbollah, or if we should adopt a new name to fit the new phase. Some of our brothers were on the US's blacklist, and there was this debate whether to keep them in Lebanon or make it for them to leave Lebanon. For example, Martyr Haj Imad Mughniyeh was on that list. So we compiled a collection of various suggestions.
Did Hezbollah not have a communication channel with Hafez al-Assad to be informed of his decision?
Yes. The point is that all the available data and information assured us that the Israeli-Syrian negotiations would result in an agreement. At that time, Hafez al-Assad's main demand was to take back the Golan, and that Israel would withdraw from the June 4, 1967 borders. And Rabin had agreed to meet those demands. Eventually, we went to see the leader. He was very patient with us, because during this visit, we mentioned all the issues raised and the suggestions offered by different people. He listened to all of our words in that meeting, which was held with some Iranian officials in attendance, and while all Iranian officials and all officials unanimously and with no exception believed that the Syrian-Israeli talks were over, His Eminence said, "It is good that you consider the worst-case scenarios and probabilities and plan to face them. That's very good. But I tell you, this will not happen, and there will be no peace treaty between Syria and Israel. So discard whatever you have written and prepared. You should continue to resist and double your efforts to increase your weapons, facilities, and human resources. Do not worry, because there will be no peace treaty between Syria and Israel." All those present in the meeting, including the Iranians and the Lebanese, were astonished by the firm remarks of Ayatollah Khamenei. His Eminence did not say that I consider it unlikely or that there might be other possibilities. Not at all. He resolutely declared this will not happen. He said strongly and firmly, forget it and put it away. Continue to do what you were doing in a better and stronger way than before. Anyways, we were surprised. We returned to Lebanon and we continued to work based on the leader's point of view. Only 2 weeks after our visit to the leader, a big ceremony with more than about 100,000 people was held in Tel Aviv, wherein Yitzhak Rabin was giving a speech, when someone from among extremist Jews opened fire at and murdered Rabin. After Rabin, Shimon Peres was elected prime minister of the Zionist regime. He had a weak personality because he was not perceived by Israelis in terms of historical and military background, as well as trustworthiness, as competent as Rabin. Subsequently, large operations were carried out inside occupied territories, namely Tel Aviv and occupied Quds, which shook the foundations of the Zionist regime's power. After that, the Sharm el-Sheikh summit that I mentioned was held. Then, in 1996, Israel attacked Lebanon in an operation called Operation Grapes of Wrath and marked the unprecedented genocide in Qanar, a tragedy later known as the Qanar Massacre. In response, we resisted against the Israelis and became victorious. Shortly thereafter, that is in 2 or 3 weeks, elections were held in the Zionist regime, during which Shimon Peres was defeated and the Likud party replaced the Labour Party as the dominant party, and Benjamin Netanyahu became the Prime Minister of Israel. After coming to power, he said, I do not adhere to any of Yitzhak Rabin's and Shimon Peres' commitments with regard to Syria and the negotiations with Hafez Assad. Therefore, the Israeli-Syrian negotiations ended. We're talking about the year 1996, and now, in 2019, where does the peace process stand? It is in its worst status.
As you pointed out, in that atmosphere, there was a feeling that an impending compromise was going on. And meanwhile, the Palestinian people were being slaughtered. Did other countries contact you to encourage Hezbollah to follow the movement? Did the countries which favored this compromise contact you in this regard? Did they send a message to encourage you to accept to compromise with Israel?
There was no direct contact with Hezbollah. They had no hopes in us because they knew about our wisdom, willpower, faith, and determination. But in general, some Arab countries pressured Lebanon. They pressured the Lebanese government and people to compromise with Israel. They threatened that Israel would destroy Lebanon if they did not accept to compromise, and the Arab world would turn away from Beirut. There were such pressures, but there was no significant contact because they knew what our stance was and we saw how they have absolutely no hopes in us. This was God's blessing for us.
Some raised the question why the Islamic Republic of Iran and Hezbollah in Lebanon cannot accept any of the projects offered by the U.S. and the Zionist regime for the compromise from Oslo to the deal of century. The question is raised why Iran and Hezbollah do not provide the prerequisites to end these conflicts. Another point about Palestine is that some imply that the Palestinians themselves are interested in some form of compromise. What is your opinion about these questions? On the other hand, we see that some Arab rulers and figures are pretentious in their support for the Palestinian cause and standing for the Palestinian aspirations. What are the indicators for identifying the true representatives of this movement and thinking? Today, who is the vanguard of supporting the aspiration of Palestinian government and leading it?
Regarding the first part of the question, I would say all the offered projects for the Palestinian cause violated the rights and the interests of the Palestinians. They say, according to the Oslo Accord, the lands usurped in 1948 are not included in the negotiations. That means two-thirds of Palestine is to be regarded outside the negotiations. Well, this is a major act of oppression. That is, in its basis and foundation, it is a major form of oppression. Then they do not even give them the remaining one-third of Palestine. They do not even say that they would give the West Bank to the Palestinians and only negotiate on East Quds. Now, at that time, even as for the Gaza Strip, the Zionists acted passively on the issue of Gaza. Shimon Peres said, "I dream of a day when I wake up and I am told that Gaza has gone underwater." Now, this was their territorial viewpoint. Now, in the case of Quds, in all the offered proposals, the Americans and Israelis never agreed to give back East Quds to the Palestinians. Even during the last negotiations in Camp David between Yasser Arafat and Ehud Barak, the matter of Quds was brought up. And there, the Israelis said, "Of Jerusalem, whatever is on the ground, for you, even the mosque, but what remains underground of Jerusalem is for us." As for the Palestinians who were expelled from their homes, the Israelis have explicitly stated that they would not allow them to return to their lands. This is while millions of displaced Palestinians were living in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and other countries of the world dispersedly. Would any wise man accept such a thing? Even if we accept the above-mentioned proposals, which are based on the two-state solution, still, a question is raised. Which Palestinian state? A state with no national sovereignty, no borders, no sky or coast, no airport, etc. Now, what kind of a state is this? Thus, the proposals that have been presented on the question of Palestine since long ago, from the Madrid negotiations to the bilateral talks and the deal of the century, all indicate that the situation has become worse day after day. Let's talk about the deal of the century. Recently, Jared Kushner spoke about the deal of the century and explicitly said that according to this plan, Jerusalem al-Quds is for Israel. He announced that major Zionist settlements in the West Bank would be part of the occupied territories. Therefore, there is basically no discussion of a two-state solution, that is, one that includes a true Palestinian state. Even the Palestinians themselves do not accept such plans. Accordingly, we gradually come to the conclusion that, firstly, if you see that the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Hezbollah of Lebanon and other resistance groups do not agree with the proposals on the Palestinian question, it is because all these proposals are very oppressive to the Palestinian nation, as well as to the Islamic Ummah overall. Secondly, the overwhelming majority of the Palestinian people won't accept these plans. Today, it's absolutely clear that there is a complete consensus among the various Palestinian groups and parties in response to the deal of the century. It's not that some of them accept and others reject the proposal. The Fatah and Hamas, as well as other movements, despite their disagreements, have no doubts about rejecting the deal of the century and are on the same page with this regard. The Palestinian nation, both inside and outside the borders of the country, reject the deal of the century. Thus, opposition to this plan is not confined to Iran and the resistance groups in the region. Rather, Palestinians themselves oppose the deal of the century. On the other hand, we must have a thorough understanding of the positions of Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Lebanese Hezbollah, and the resistance groups against the Zionist regime. The fact is that Israel is not a problem only for the Palestinians. Rather, the stabilization of the sovereignty of Israel is a threat not only to the Palestinians, but also to all Arab and Islamic countries. The stabilization of this regime is a big threat to Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Jordan, and even the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, Israel has nuclear weapons and more than 200 nuclear warheads. The regime has always sought to expand its dominance over the whole region. Now, there's another important point that we have learned from Imam Khomeini and also Ayatollah Khamenei, which is the fact that Israel is not a regime independent from the United States. Rather, it's regarded as a US arm in the region. Who is after warmongering in the region? Who conducts invasion and aggression? Who meddles into other countries' affairs? Hence, the existence, survival, power, and promotion of Israel, either through peaceful or non-peaceful means, is a major security threat for all the countries in the region, from the Islamic Republic of Iran to Pakistan, and even for the countries of Central Asia, as well as Turkey. Therefore, those resisting Israel today are in fact defending the Palestinian people and their rights, of which they have been divested, and they are also defending themselves, the sanctities, and defending Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, Iraq, and other countries. Israel will not withdraw from the Nile to Euphrates goal, and this goal has always been presented as a Torah dream Israel has been trying to realize. Now, Israel is a military base in the region that serves the interests of the United States. We all know that the United States wants Iran to return to the pre-revolutionary times, that is, a monarchy, just like Saudi Arabia, so that whenever it demands oil, Iran would give oil, and whenever it demands oil prices be dropped, it gets realized. Now, you saw that Trump personally declared that he took $450 billion from Riyadh. Trump openly announced that receiving this $450 billion was much easier for him than receiving $100 from an illegitimate booth somewhere in New York. He wants Iran to be like Saudi Arabia. In fact, he wants all countries in the region to be just like Saudi Arabia. Who is Saudi Arabia relying on? On the monarchists in the region, as well as the Israeli entity that possesses nuclear weapons and threatens countries of the region. Accordingly, the important strategy emphasized by Imam Khomeini was that if we want to have a safe region, live in permanent peace, defend our national sovereignty and integrity of lands, and if we want all countries of the region to enjoy national sovereignty and true freedom, none of them is possible to achieve as long as there is an Israeli entity. They seek to fixate the Israeli entity by means of peace treaties.
Today, who is the vanguard of supporting the aspiration of Palestinian government and leading it?
Today, there is no question that Ayatollah Khamenei, may God continue his oversight, bears the flag of the Palestinian cause. Today, no one doubts that the Islamic Republic of Iran, with its determination, will and power, is the vanguard and the main nucleus and main pivot that steers the resistance movement.
Israel and its authorities announced in 2000 that they would leave southern Lebanon and try to pretend it was voluntary. Did they voluntarily leave, or were they forced to leave southern Lebanon?
The Israelis wanted to retreat from southern Lebanon due to the significant financial and human forces damage imposed on them by the resistance. There is no doubt that it was the resistance and their operations that forced Israel to leave southern Lebanon. In Lebanon, no one has any doubt about it. That is to say, everyone acknowledges it. Had it not been for the resistance's daily operations, Israel would have remained in southern Lebanon. There is no doubt about it. Of course, the Israelis, even when they were under the most extreme pressure from the resistance, tried to gain a concession from the opponents and to impose their prerequisites on Syria and Lebanon. Now, at that time, Lebanon, as well as Syria, whose president was Hafez al-Assad, rejected granting any concession to Israel. This helped the Lebanese government a lot, since Syria had a significant influence on the Lebanese government and helped it to reject Israel's conditions. Here, I would like to add a point about the talks between Yitzhak Rabin and Hafez Assad. Now, one of the factors contributing to the discontinuation of the Israeli-Syrian negotiations process at that time was the stance Hafez al-Assad took. Because when the Israelis came to the June 4th borders, Hafez Assad insisted to take back the Lake Tiberia. He said that it belonged to Syria and had to be returned to Syria. Now, this was one of the factors that led to the discontinuation of Syrian-Israeli negotiations after the death of Yitzhak Rabin and under the rule of Shimon Peres. Now, let's go back to the issue of southern Lebanon. We were saying that the Israelis tried to receive concessions from Syria and Lebanon and impose their prerequisites on them. The Syrian and Lebanese governments also expressed their opposition to this issue. Hezbollah and the resistance in Lebanon also rejected it. On the other hand, Hezbollah resistance continued its operations until the Israelis came to the conclusion that their remaining in Lebanon was costly and they could not gain any concessions from Lebanon. So they decided to leave southern Lebanon without any prerequisites. Also note that at that time, there were domestic pressures in the occupied lands on the part of settlers on the Israeli regime to leave Syria, especially because the families of the Israeli military and the families of the dead were demanding Israel not to stay in Lebanon. More interestingly, they had set July 2000 as the date for leaving Lebanon, but the intensity of the operations of the resistance forced Tel Aviv to withdraw from Lebanon, and thus, with complete humiliation and precipitation, the regime's military forces left southern Lebanon. This occurred by God's grace.
I would like to ask another question, and I'm willing to close this discussion here. Ayatollah Khamenei said a few years ago that Israel won't survive to see the next 25 years.
Before coming to that, we need to finish the topic of the year 2000 victory. I remember a very important memory of Ayatollah Khamenei. You remember I said that in 1996, His Eminence had said no peace treaty would be achieved between Syria and Israel. Now, in the year 2000, a few months before Israel's withdrawal from southern Lebanon, and in accordance with our plans, we traveled to Tehran to meet with Imam Khamenei and the Iranian officials. We, that is the Hezbollah Council, traveled to Iran. On that trip, we also were accompanied by the military commanders of the resistance for the first time. Nearly 50 commanders of the resistance a company does on that trip. And at that time, we thought that Israel would not retreat from Lebanon in 2000. We were not sure, but we assumed it was unlikely that Israel would retreat in 2000, because we believed that Israel would not accept to retreat without imposing some prerequisites. We said to the leader, "It's unlikely that Israel will withdraw from southern Lebanon. It seems that Israel will stay longer in Lebanon, and we will need more time and more operations to make Israel withdraw with no preconditions." Then he asked, "Why do you think this is unlikely?" We responded, "Because this measure would be a major threat to Israel. Israel withdrawing from South Lebanon with no preconditions represents a victory for the resistance, and this will be considered the very first obvious victory of resistance, naturally affecting Palestine and Palestinian nations' domestic developments, something that would pose a strategic threat to Israel and would signal to Palestinians the message that the main path is that of resistance and not negotiations, a message that told them, negotiations took your lands and sanctities away from you, but resistance liberated Lebanon and South Lebanon." It was then that the leader stated, "I recommend you to seriously assume that Israel will leave Lebanon, and you will be victorious. You continue your activities and plan for the future based on this assumption. Plan on how to face Israel's retreat from Lebanon on military, fieldwork, media, and political aspects." Now, we were surprised to hear these words, because we all believed that Ehud Barak, who had just won the election, would not act on his promise of retreat, because his conditions had not been met, and particularly that he had not achieved security commitments either. That is to say, neither the Lebanese government, nor the Syrian government, and nor Hezbollah of Lebanon had made security commitments to Israel. Thus, the question was that, how would it be possible that Israel would retreat? This seemed unwise and illogical. Even more important than that, following the meeting, in the evening we went to the leader's home with our brothers from the resistance, including the late Haj Imad Mughniya. Our brothers were those from the resistance, fighting on the front lines of the battle and could be martyred at any moment. After entering the leader's house, we and our brothers went to a great hall where prayers were performed. At the time, our brothers were wearing military uniforms with kefayas worn around their necks and looked a lot like the besiegees on the Iranian fronts. We were only supposed to perform congregational prayers with Imam Khamenei and to offer our greetings before ending the ceremony. The leader performed the prayers, and after finishing the Isha prayers, he rose to greet his Lebanese brothers. Then Imam Khamenei told his companions to move away. Then he said to me, "I'm here to listen to you. I'm here to listen to you." At this moment, one of our brothers came and kissed the leader's hand. Some of the brothers began to cry, and some of them were so impressed that could no longer stand on their feet. They slowly came forward. One of the brothers kissed the leader's hand, and when the second one bent down to kiss his feet, he did not allow it. He went back and told me, "Tell them to sit down and calm down so we can talk." A speech was not planned for that ceremony. I asked my brothers to keep calm, and I started translating the leader's speech for them. Among the issues he addressed, which I believe emerged from his spiritual vision and not simply from political analysis, rather from something deeper, was that he said, "You will be victorious by the grace of God. Your victory is much, much closer than what some people might think. He pointed to me because we had said that Israel's withdrawal in such a manner was unlikely. Pointing with his left hand like this, he turned to me and said, "Each and every one of you will see with your own eyes that you will be victorious." And so we returned back to Lebanon. At that time, we carried out large operations. And of course, many members of the resistance were martyred. May 25th came, and Israel's surprising, unexpected, and undignified retreat from southern Lebanon began. Also, some of our brothers were martyred during our progress towards the border. It was here that both predictions of Imam Khamenei were realized. First, the victory of the resistance happened very soon, only a few months after that meeting. And second, all the people who were present at the meeting with the leader and participated in the frontline operations lived on to witness the great victory with their own eyes.
The question I wanted to ask before was that Ayatollah Khamenei said a few years ago that Israel would not see 25 years from now. There were interpretations of this sentence. Some people considered it to be definitive, and they started counting the days until it comes true. On the other hand, the front of arrogance began to scoff at some of the interpretations of this statement. You have stood against the Zionist regime at different times and experienced various battles against this regime. Given your experiences, when you heard this statement from Ayatollah Khamenei, what was your perception and feelings about it?
First, I was not personally surprised by the remarks made by Imam Khamenei, because we had heard similar statements in our private meetings in the previous years, especially in the year 2000, after the victory over the Zionist regime. We paid a visit to Imam Khamenei a few months after the victory, and he was very delighted of the victory. We spoke about the future. At that time, he said, if the Palestinian people, the resistance in Lebanon, and the nations of the region perform their duties appropriately, and we continue this path, then certainly Israel cannot last for a long time in the region. At that time, he mentioned something less than 25 years. So when I heard the leader's 25 years remark, I somehow concluded that he's given Israel extra time. That's why I was not so surprised. On the other hand, it should be mentioned that the leader's statement on Israel is absolutely serious. According to our experiences, some of which I already mentioned, we believe that the leader is a person endorsed by Allah, the Almighty, and that what His Eminence states sometimes emerges from some other source, as it happened in the 33-day war. It should also be noted that all data, investigations, and information show that such an event, that is, the elimination of Israel, will occur. But the realization of this matter would happen only under certain conditions. And that is, if only the resistance continues what it's doing in the region and not surrender to Israel, and that Iran continues its support for the resistance in the region. Therefore, if we resist and continue on the path we've taken, factual and field conditions indicate that Israel will not be able to remain in the region in the next 25 years. Let me make an example to better clarify the issue. We have done a lot of research and studies on the Israeli regime in the past years, trying to find answers for the following questions. What are the foundations of this regime? Or, in other words, What are the hidden factors that have led to the existence of this regime? What are the strengths and weaknesses of this regime? Therefore, this issue goes to show that the resistance in its path has always exploited research as well as the power of logic and thinking based on the existing facts and data. Although there has been a revolutionary spirit, self-confidence and determination in the fight against Zionism, this does not mean that this fight lacked the research and rationality to identify the enemy's weaknesses and strengths to act accordingly. Now, this is our viewpoint, and if you'd like me to tap on the details, I have no problems with that. I say this based on the foundation of the internal and external structure of the Israeli regime, as well as its weaknesses and strengths. And, of course, I do not know about the secret dimensions of Imam Khamenei's words. Now, based on field studies and real investigations, we can clearly say that Israel cannot survive. I say this because the existence of Israel in the region is not a natural existence. Rather, its existence does not match the nature of the region. This entity has been imposed on the region and hence cannot become normalized and turn into a normal issue. Moreover, even if the Arab monarchs, emirs, and rulers want it, all the nations of the region oppose the existence of Israel and firmly reject this illegitimate entity against their rulers' will. The elements of weakness are ample in the Israeli entity, so the likelihood of the collapse of this regime is very high. I refer to two examples of Israel's apparent weakness. First, Israel's power is now heavily dependent on the power of the United States. Consequently, if anything happens to the United States of America, like what happened to the USSR, from the collapse of its economy to internal problems and discords and natural disasters or any other incident that might get the US busy dealing with its problems and lead to a reduction of Washington's influence in the region, you will see that the Israelis will get their stuff and evacuate in the shortest possible time. Therefore, their destruction does not necessarily entail a war. The Israeli regime's existence in Palestine depends on the US's spiritual, psychological, military, and economic support. Now, if the US gets busy with its own problems, Israel will have no chance to survive, and there would be no need for a war with that regime. This is just one example, truly foreseeable. Everyone knows that the United States allocates an annual amount of $3 billion to Israel. Meanwhile, Israelis enjoy $10 billion worth of US banking facilities per year. A part of US taxpayers' money is spent on Israel. Moreover, the most advanced technologies are transferred to Israel. Washington's support for Israel is completely obvious. One of the most important reasons behind the humiliated stances taken by Arab regimes towards Israel is their fear of the United States, not fear of Israel itself. If a day comes when some Arab regimes and Arab armies free themselves from pressure by the United States, their stances towards Israel will be different. Even the armies and the regimes themselves will take a different stance. Let me make another example. The governments of the world usually build armies for themselves. But with regards to the Zionist regime, it is said that Israel is an army made for the regime. Now, in the world, a country's army might collapse, but that country will stand. For example, after the US war on Iraq, the Americans dissolved the Iraqi army, But Iraq remained and did not disappear. There are countries in the world that do not have an army or have a weak army. However, Israel is a regime that cannot survive without a strong army. If its army is defeated, or if the truth of the Israeli army, that is, its weakness and instability, is disclosed to the settlers, and they realize that this army is incapable of supporting them, you will see the Israelis will get their stuff and flee. My dear brothers, Israel has many lethal weaknesses. And that is why I believe that in the shade of a national willpower against the survival of this regime, regional and international events will take place in this regard. I am among those who strongly believe in the new generation, and God willing, this generation will enter Palestine and perform prayers in Quds, and there will be no Israel.